When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Shutdown Fullcast. Oh, I'm feeling a little bloody this week. Jason Kirk?
Hey, they make ointments for that.
I'm feeling in my hemoglobin on this here.
Not better.
The only college football podcast on this here internet. I'm feeling a little low in my iron.
So Spencer, what is hemoglobin?
Hemoglobin is the carrier of oxygen. It's what oxygen binds to on a red blood cell.
He learned that on a weightlifting message board.
Darn right. How do you think you get the gains? You got to get the O2 and the steak. That's what binds. To the red
blood. I mean, where else do we learn any biology facts other than weightlifting message boards?
Other than I got a PhD in human performance from TNation.com University. Okay. But I was using this as a way to segue clumsily through a very poorly written Wikipedia entry on blood oxygen transfer to our topic this week. Jason, you want to learn them up on our favorite thing that happens in college football, which is blood week.
Blood week. So
blood week.
A couple years ago, I believe it was Ryan who coined the term of blood week, which has since, as in the one season since, become a thing that members of our extended podcast universe look forward to each college football season. Saturday, you know, the weekend's falling apart. We've had the number three team is lost or whatever. And immediately we see listeners start saying, uh-oh, is this the blood week? And every season is going to have at least one. And you sort of know it once it's happened or as it's happening. It's when lots of top teams are losing upsets. You know, the bigger the upset, the better. Everything is falling apart. Everything's going to shit. Usually it happens right around the middle of the season.
Jason, can you give us a super famous example?
Well, I think the two examples that we've had in this in the Blood Week era have been last year's Week 7, which Georgia loses to LSU. West Virginia loses as a top 10 team. Washington and Penn State lose as top 10 teams. Colorado, Auburn, and Miami also ranked and lost upsets. The previous year's Week 7 was the one that launched this whole concept. Clemson loses to Syracuse. Washington State gets blown the fuck out by a 5-7 Cal team. Washington scores like 2 points against Arizona State's terrible defense, and four other ranked teams lose to unranked teams. So what we're going to attempt to do here is we would like to sort of view this historically. Let's find some other blood weeks throughout time. And we've taken a look at sort of, let's start with Week 1, which is kind of a nebulous concept in college football because you're kind of, depending on the era of the sport, you might be lumping in a little bit of Week 0, a little bit of Week 2. But basically, let's go with the point in the season at which everyone has played a game. And let's call that Week 1, basically. And I had a few contender Week 1s that we could have considered blood weeks to sort of run through real quick. But then there's one that we're going to go through in detail. And you can't go past really 1950 for this if you're talking preseason, because there was no preseason poll before then. But
participation trophy culture, y'all.
When people say, what's the point of preseason rankings? I want this episode to be the answer for you because there's so much comedy we would not have without those little numbers next to names.
Yeah, how can you fall if we don't put you on a pedestal to start the season?
Right. How can we laugh at Notre Dame and USC every year?
They're full of rum, but you know.
Go Tigers.
So 1960, you have five top 13 teams losing right away to unranked teams. One of those is number 4, Texas, to Nebraska, I believe.
Weird. Texas getting a high ranking and then forfeiting it quickly.
Yeah, that never happens. 1976, four top 10 teams lose upsets, and Five other ranked teams lose twice, including Miami of Ohio twice as the number 20 team.
And that's when we as a nation great. That's when we as a nation turned on them. Never again, Miami of Ohio.
We've had it with your shit.
You broke our hearts.
You are 0-2 at number 20.
I was going to make the noise of an actual Red Hawk into the mic, but I thought it might blow the speakers out. Scree.
I think once you're 0-2, it's like a scree.
It's like a little, it's like a sad, roomy Nazgul.
Scree. You have to sort of change the standards as you go through from era to era, because now teams play 12 games, which means they start with a bullshit opponent. 2005, this is deep into the cupcake era. Still, five ranked teams lose upsets right away, including an Oklahoma that had just participated in the BCS title game. I use the word participated generously. That was the one where they lost by about a billion points. 2007, speaking of cupcakes. So basically nothing happened in week one of the craziest season in college football history except number five Michigan lost its cupcake game to an FCS team that it was actually a cupcake made of nails.
You might have heard that.
That was a mistake there. You ordered the just.
Dang it.
Do we really want to punch on Michigan this week? They're having a minute.
They're sending guys to the pros. I don't see what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Oh, an excellent point.
I mean, I'm just reading the facts here. So just what the card said.
Can I go ahead and just make fun of John Balin for this? That his great escape at the age of 66 from Michigan was to Cleveland.
Ann Arbor's a beautiful town. I wouldn't go to Cleveland from Ann Arbor.
I want to change it up. You know, I'm 66. I worked hard for things. You know where I think I'm going to go? Cleveland.
Listen, just paving the way for Tom Crean, baby.
Yeah, let's focus. Focus on Tom Crean. Crean's coming home.
Come on,
Mama's man. Calling.
Mama's calling.
More technically, mother-in-law is calling, but still.
I mean, he went to college in Michigan or whichever it was, right?
His brother-in-law is Jim Harbaugh.
Yeah.
So,
if there's one thing about being related to Jim Harbaugh, it's that you want to be closer to him than you already are. Definitely an excuse for more Jim Harbaugh in your life. Although,
if only I could borrow his pants.
You're bunking with me, but I can buy my own house. No way. You're sleeping at my house.
A couple lessons in losing with grace. Maybe Tom Crean can help him out as a mentor on that front.
The other contender for a week one blood week is recent. 2016, three top 10 teams lose upsets, including number 3 LSU to unranked Wisconsin, and four other ranked teams lose. This was slaughter right out of the gates, and I don't think it really registered to that level.
Can't spell slaughter without laughter.
The greatest opening blood week in college football history comes to us from 1990, which was a crazy season in general. You had one champ that never won a title before. You had another champ that hadn't been in the top 10 at any point since 1966. 18 different teams ranked in the top five at least once, the most of any season ever. We looked this up as part of our 2000 season package, which you should go read about on the internet. And like, this was the season where, like, you know, a team got five downs and that mattered a lot. Virginia mattered. This was a very stupid season. It was stupid from the very beginning, which was actually a week zero. Actually, before it got really stupid, there was an early upset that sort of set the tone and would come to circle back around to mattering by the end, which is a week zero kickoff game in Anaheim called the Disneyland Pigskin Classic.
What could go wrong in Disneyland?
What about a tradition of unsatisfying sporting events happening in Anaheim Stadium could possibly happen here? Well, I'll tell you. I should point out, first of all, that while we're talking about, and I would like to start this off by saying that people have always thought, and I have newspaper evidence I've accumulated researching this game, people have always thought these week zero neutral site games were kind of bullshit. You can look at a lot of the newspaper coverage, we're talking about Tennessee and Colorado, by the way. I should point this out. Colorado ranked number 5 coming into the 1990 season. Tennessee coming in ranked number 8. This is the inaugural Disneyland Pigskin Classic played in mall country of Anaheim Stadium. And even back then, people thought these games were kind of weird. You can see it referred to in newspaper coverage from both schools as a preseason game, although I think both schools by the end of it might have wished that this actually had been a preseason game and then didn't end up counting. So the game ended 31-31, which is kind of funny, but you know, ties were a thing back then. And it's not as remarkable as it obviously would be today because they didn't take it into overtime. I applaud both teams for wanting to spend as little time in Anaheim as possible. So why did this matter? Colorado would end the season ranked number one. They would beat number five, Notre Dame, along the way. Along the way, they would also lose to Illinois, which is weird, but Illinois was ranked number 21, which makes it even funnier. And then follow that up by immediately beating Texas in Austin. Sure. They would then beat Nebraska at Nebraska 27-12, and Nebraska, I believe, was ranked third at the time. So this game was more of a harbinger for a blood season for Colorado is what I'm really trying to get at. For Tennessee, this was not this didn't end up affecting things a whole bunch. Tennessee would go on to lose twice that season. They'd finish the year eighth. They would tie Auburn also along the way. Lost to Bama and Notre Dame. I don't like this season. I don't like this season at all. Although they did beat number 9 Florida 43-3 because blood week can take a minute to work its way out of the bloodstream once a program becomes exposed. Tennessee and Colorado would have another common opponent that season in Notre Dame. Tennessee lost to Notre Dame, remember, 29-34. Won the SEC and beat Virginia in the Sugar Bowl. So, the game itself. There were 5 touchdowns scored in the fourth quarter. And this is 1990. Everybody's on the ground. There were 5 touchdowns scored in the fourth quarter, scored in such a fashion that Colorado blew a 2-score lead twice in one period.
Wow. Well, once you do it once, you know how. So,
Tennessee did have the ball again as time expired, but only made it as far as the 16. And there was some minor feather. If you look at the front page of the New Sentinel or the Tennessean, at the time, the left-hand side says, a Disney deadlock, and it's the account of the game. And the right-hand column is all people bitching about how Johnny Majors should have gone for 2 after UT's final touchdown. But there were 5 touchdowns scored in that period. He had no – I'm not a Johnny Majors enthusiast, as we longtime listeners of the fam will know. But he had no reason to think there wasn't going to be 5 or 6 more touchdowns.
Should have kicked the field goal from his own 16.
Yeah, clearly. But all these questions paled next to what would be thrown at Colorado a few weeks later, because Colorado was going through it, man. This was also the fifth down game season. My favorite part about the fifth down game, the Colorado-Missouri game in 1990, is that the officials didn't lose count of the downs at the end. They lost count after the second down, actually, in that series, and nobody noticed. And that game was just that game was like a layer cake of controversies. There was the lost count of downs, the did Charles Johnson, Colorado's backup quarterback, even cross the goal line. Bill McCartney, of course, coach of Colorado, had played at Missouri, so was he a plant? Speaking of plants, Missouri's shitty field had led to a bunch of slips and falls, and everyone was mad at that anyway. But yeah, this was this blood week was a harbinger for things to come for Colorado, and they ended up sharing the title with an undefeated Georgia Tech. And I would like to close out my remarks on this game by pointing out that despite having 2 top 10 teams and Disneyland-backed branding for this neutral site week 0 game, only 33,000 people came out to see Colorado and Tennessee play. Early season neutral site games have always been bullshit. Mass has ended. Go in peace.
So if Johnny Majors had gone for 2 there in that situation, you would either have an outright Colorado national title at the end because Colorado's strength of schedule this year was completely insane, yeah, or you would have an outright Georgia Tech national title because you would have a 2-loss Colorado that should have been a 3-loss Colorado. So, yeah, like,
Georgia Tech was the only undefeated team that season, but Colorado, after losing to goddamn Illinois and tying Tennessee in the first 3 weeks, went on to be 5 ranked teams, if you count their Orange Bowl win over Notre Dame, including, of course, number 3 Nebraska in the first week of November, at Lincoln.
Yeah, this is, I think, SRS, Sports References, Strength of Schedule Metric has them. I looked at it earlier. It's either number two or number three in the country in strength of schedule, which is really fucking hard to go through that with only one official loss. So, like, if they'd beaten Tennessee, they would have had the outright title, you know. In it, but otherwise, Tech would have had. So basically, thank you, Johnny Majors, for making this season as bullshit as it was.
Hey, everybody's good at something.
Solomonic in his wisdom.
The weirdest thing about this is the Colorado was really good. Like, absolutely fantastically good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, setting aside, they split the title, and so we're going to make fun of them, but they won the Big Eight. They won the Orange Bowl.
Man, they beat Nebraska and Lincoln, didn't
they? I mean, I think the weirdest thing is that. Right. I think the weirdest thing is that they lost to an Illinois team, and that wasn't disqualifying for a national championship at the time.
Happened to Ohio State a few years later.
You know what?
Wait, now hang on. Now I want to look at the 1990 Illinois team and see what else they ended up doing.
I will tell you why they weren't coming out to the game in Anaheim. They had to go see Delta Force 2, the Colombian connection.
Jesus.
Chuck Norris, which came out 2 days prior.
Congratulations, Spencer has done 5 minutes of Wikipedia research.
Oh, brother, I'm about to dunk you in the biggest trash can of information.
Oh, wow. Illinois had opened that season with a loss at Arizona.
Blood week!
Illinois had a week one bye. Lost to Arizona in week two, beat Colorado in week three, and then went on through a season in which they mostly beat good teams and lost to bad teams, except they lost to Clemson in the Hall of Fame Bowl in Tampa.
Mm-hmm. By a score of what?
By a score of 30 to nothing.
Yeah, so we're including Illinois in Blood Week, week one here, because, like, yeah, you know, several teams just didn't play in just disrupted traditional norms of week one as teams did at the time. And Illinois came into the season ranked number 11 and lost to Arizona. So this counts.
Yeah.
Arizona
yeah.
was unranked.
This is
biggest. Jam. The biggest garbage can of information is in the running for Shutdown Fullcast tagline, just so you know.
Also, this was an Illinois team that was recovering from the loss of Jeff George, first-round draft pick.
He can still start. He can still start today. Put him out there.
They could use him.
I love looking at the scores of this era and just, like, kind of basking in the warmth of how much they feel of a place. Like, the Illinois beat Michigan State 15-13. In that, but then you scroll down and you see, wait a second. Okay, they lost to Iowa. Iowa was ranked 13th at the time. They lost 28-54 to Iowa at home.
Ohio yeah. State did that too.
Ah, many people are saying.
This is an Iowa team that also put up 56 points on Northwestern, 45 on Iowa State, and 63 on Cincy. So.
Welcome to our 1990 Illinois football podcast.
Oh, my God. This is somebody's kink, and they are having the best time.
Oh, PAPM, we're out for your audience share.
So coming into this season and sort of like from that week zero game onward, things were making sense. Miami was your number one. They were your defending reigning national champion. They had at least a couple dozen draft picks on the roster. They were followed by Notre Dame, FSU. Teams that had finished behind them the year before. Auburn was right up there. They just won the Iron Bowl over like a number two Alabama. So like there was no reason to suspect anything was awry. Miami, of course, number one Miami, took off the week 0.5, I guess, and picked it up in week one, mark two, with whom, Ryan?
BYU, a road game in Utah. This was... Man, this Miami team was fucking good. At least they had been the year before. The year before this game, the opponent passing yards they allowed by game, 96, 85, 301, the one outlier, 141, 109, 142, 134, 154, 163, 106, 214, an average of 149 passing yards allowed per game. I could not find the stats for the Eastern Carolina game. I'm going to guess that they didn't bump this number up.
Gracious.
And then Ty Detmer came along, and Ty Detmer threw 54 passes for 406 yards and two touchdowns and one pick. against the Miami Hurricanes in a game where he took several big hits, but only got sacked twice, sidestepped a bunch of other big hits. The you can go back and find the full video, video of this game on YouTube. I won't tell you where, because that's how the authorities will catch us. But on, I believe it's what is the go-ahead touchdown for BYU in the third quarter, he sidesteps two Miami defenders who essentially collide into each other. It's like watching a Three Stooges thing unfold in front of you. But the true hero of this game, even though Ty Detmer was great, Earl Kaufman.
Yes!
For BYU.
Earl Rising.
Does anybody...
The Leg of Thunder. The Boomin' Mormon.
Now, Earl Kaufman was the field goal kicker, the punter, and he handled kickoffs. In this game, he made 2 of 3 field goals. He averaged 53 yards a punt on 4 punts, and all 6 of his kickoffs went unreturned. He was...
Also brought snacks.
That's probably true. Yeah. What's an Earl? Well, Jason would know. What's an Earl bringing snack wise to a football game?
Well, according to the internet, Earl Kaufman is a junior high school guidance counselor. So, no man on earth is more qualified to bring snacks.
Thumbprint cookies.
Who's at this game? Who's the offensive coordinator for BYU? It's Norm Chow. Who are assistants on this Miami team? Ed Orgeron and Tommy Tuberville. Who's playing offensive lineman? I think he's. I don't think he was a starter. I'm not sure. Mario,
Brian,
Chris,
can we pause for a quick game?
Sure.
How old is Ed Orgeron? I'm not sure I could pin him down to a decade.
I know he's older than Tommy Tuberville based on when they graduated from college. What's your guess? Everybody, give me a guess.
Between 20 and 180.
Okay, Jason's correct.
I'm putting Ed Orgeron at 57.
Spencer hit it on the dot.
Wow.
57, a couple months away from 58.
Old guy. Anyway, expert,
thank you for
Spencer
entertaining
Hall.
That. It just, I never think of him as being any age, but whatever the hell age he is now.
I do recommend you go back and watch the fourth quarter of this game. The whole game is actually very entertaining, but the fourth quarter, you end the third with BYU up 28-21, which is the final score. Spoiler. But this is what happens. Miami starts with the ball. They already have the ball at the end of the third. They're at their own 40. They get to the BYU 15, and on first down, Craig Erickson fumbles the snap. BYU recovers. BYU goes 3 and out. Thanks to their booming punter, Miami starts at their own 35. They go 3 and out. BYU, with good field position, loses a fumble on their second play of the drive, giving Miami the ball in BYU territory. They get all the way down to the 11-yard line, thanks in part to a fourth down conversion, where Craig Erickson throws a miraculously picked off ball in the end zone. BYU goes 3 and out again. Boom and punt. Miami starts at their own 27. They convert a 4th and 7, but they effectively are dead when they can't convert a second fourth down from the BYU 25. It is, it's tense. It's an interesting clash of like, there's a little bit of a style clash there on BYU's last possession where they're basically just trying to kill clock. They run the ball on first down and then they throw the ball twice and pick up like a 3rd and 8 to effectively kill the game. It's also really weird to now watch a football game where there's nothing on the screen for most of the time. They will occasionally pop up the time when when the ball's about to be snapped. They will put up the down and distance. The score is not usually up there. It's just a very weird retro experience to be like, yes, this is how we all used to watch football. In a mostly information void, if you were just new, if you were just tuning in. But it still worked. But how did the seasons end for these two teams? Well... despite Ty Detmer's Herculean efforts, it wasn't a great season for BYU. It wasn't terrible. They still made a bowl game. They still finished respectably. They got killed by Hawaii, I think, late in the year. They lost the Holiday Bowl to Texas A&M. Miami has a very good season, but not quite enough to get into the national championship conversation. I think they lose one other game besides this to Florida State, if memory serves. They go to the Cotton Bowl and win against Texas. Texas and Texas A&M tied together for some strange reason in the 90s. Never again, though. Never again.
Can I remind everyone, by the way, as a fun fact, of the name of BYU's defensive coordinator that year?
Please do.
Dick Felt.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
I don't get it.
Like a puppet boner, Jason.
This Miami Texas game, is there anything noteworthy about the box score from that game by chance?
I would have to look. You can remind
this
me.
This is the game where this is the Randall Hill Finger Guns game. This is the Miami racked up 780
looked.
Personal fouls and they won, I think, 46-3.
They did.
This is the most Miami game of all time. And if not for fucking BYU, it would have probably clinched Miami the second leg of a at least partial three-peat.
The Hurricanes set Cotton Bowl and school records for most penalties and most penalty yards in a single
202
game.
202 yards of penalties.
That's not in Florida.
Nine of those penalties were for unsportsmanlike conduct or personal fouls.
You know, that's an ethos that's just ahead of its time, is what I'm seeing here.
And the best part is, for some reason on CBS, they have Mike Francesa doing color.
Oh, God, this
was
that
that's
game.
Right.
This is just a disgrace.
This is my favorite line from this Wikipedia entry for the 91 Cotton Bowl. Several national publications called for Miami to suspend the coach for part of the next season. That's Dennis Erickson. Parenthetical. These suggestions were ignored, and Erickson led Miami to a national title that season.
I like that the most Miami team of all time was beaten by dudes named Earl and Ty.
Yeah.
Also,
BYU can fight. We've covered this.
Yeah.
When they rolled up to fight Memphis in the Miami Beach Bowl, they were really just carrying on a legacy. This wasn't a new frontier. This was a reboot, son.
That's true. Lamar Thomas is part of this Miami team as well. So
you know how mad all that bike riding makes you?
My favorite part of the BYU-Miami box score is other than the thundering leg of our man Earl, is one team had five turnovers. Was it Miami? No.
No, it was not.
They're just being neighborly.
Yeah, the generous Cougars.
It's also, if you go back and watch this game, it's fucking loud. It is extremely loud in that stadium.
This is maybe for another episode, but have you ever played that game where you wanted to pit teams from different eras against each other? Not so much like good 92 Bama beat 2019 Bama, but like, I want this Hurricanes era team to play Bronco Mendenhall's peak dick punching BYU teams,
mm-hmm.
and just see who comes out on a stretcher.
I want this era Miami team to play like the, let's say 4 years ago, Miami team. Fuck y'all.
Who comes out on a stretcher, I mean coaches. I don't want the players to get injured. I want them to, you know, hit opposing coaches.
Al Golden has died.
Hey, let's not be specific.
But he's already dressed for his funeral, so we got that going for us.
My favorite Al Golden comparison remains the time Ryan said he was like a partially melted American Girl doll.
So sweaty.
So that game right there, BYU-Miami, is a large part of the reason that this is the greatest week one blood week in the history of college football. You had number one, a like dominant, imposing, extremely athletic, talented number one going down. But that's not all, of course. We had, you know, Colorado had a misstep. We have number 19 Clemson losing by 13 to lower ranked Virginia, which would matter for a while, at least for like a month. Virginia football was very important. Clemson coach Ken Hatfield would soon choose to leave for Rice.
Ooh.
Making him the second Clemson head coach to choose to leave for Rice after Jess Neely in 1940. There's a pipeline.
You know how those Palmetto State people love to buy.
They didn't write that into Dabo's contract. You'll notice.
Yeah. The buyout is quadruple if he leaves for Rice. You also had Colorado. This isn't a loss, but I'm going to count it because after that struggle with Tennessee, they barely squeak past a 4-4 Stanford at home. Colorado looking real suspect. By the way, before the hard games begin. You, of course, have number 11, Illinois, which would beat Colorado. Again, Colorado quite suspicious, losing by 12 to unranked Arizona. Number 19, UCLA, loses by 20 at home to lower-ranked Oklahoma. Why was UCLA ranked, having gone 3-7-1 the year prior?
Why does UCLA play football in week one?
Why did they play it in the other weeks either?
No, I mean, why does UCLA play football in September?
Shouldn't the Pac-12 just kick off in November?
That's Disneyland Pigskin Classic time, damn it.
I'll go to Anaheim.
I think the reason, of course, that UCLA was ranked was they had future XFL MVP Tommy Maddox at the helm.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Oklahoma, meanwhile, is quarterbacked by Cale Gundy, who is now one of like 14 different Oklahoma offensive coordinators. Yeah, it's the other Gundy, yeah.
Yeah.
There's several Gundys. You had number 21, Penn State, losing at home to unranked Texas. No comment. This was 1990s Penn State. Well, next. Number 25, West Virginia, lost at home to unranked Maryland. Also, the Missouri that would basically beat Colorado lost to 3-5 TCU. Again, Colorado is not really holding up well here.
The Missouri that would basically beat Colorado would be a hell of a banner.
An actual national champ, Georgia Tech, beats a 7-5 NC State. Georgia Tech handled its business. By the time the whole country had kicked off, 8 ranked teams had suffered upsets, including number 1. However, I have not mentioned perhaps the most entertaining of these games. Spencer, what do you have?
Well, I really want to start a year earlier, because we got to start this brewing for you, okay? Because we are talking about upsets in 1990. However, the foundations of this were laid well before then, because this concerns the University of Alabama. And as we all know, the University of Alabama, the drama never ends, and its roots go back deep. They go decades deep.
They're extremely emotional men.
Deeply emotional men, deeply felt about their sport.
Dick felt
about their sport, in fact. Hands on it, because that's how you show you need this.
Hands on a hard body.
So Alabama comes into 1990 with a new coach. Their new coach is Gene Stallings, by the way. Because remember, after Bear Bryant died, they kind of had a
problem. Bear Bryant's not dead. He's frozen.
That's right. And he will come back when Nick Saban retires.
Like Captain Marvel, other planets needed him.
I went to Mars. They have no cigarette machines.
Man, other plants, you know who could really use like a post-Thanos cleanup right now is Gene Stallings. That man would have the grill out.
He would. He'd be like, you snap, but I'm still here making burgers.
more burgers for Gene, actually.
Yeah.
Other planets like Arkansas and Kentucky needed Bear Bryant.
Texas A&M, definitely another planet that Bear Bryant actually coached at. Senator Gene Stallings, by the way, a job from which he was fired. In fact, Stallings gets this job not because of his record. In fact, his record when he comes to Alabama in 1990, it's not real good. In fact, he said it wasn't real good either. He wasn't that great a pro coach. He wasn't that great a college coach, actually. He comes to Alabama after two gigs with a 50-81-2 record at both coaching the Cardinals of the NFL and A&M at college. How did he get the job? He was a Bear guy. Now, all the other guys before
him. Now, when you say a Bear guy.
A Bear guy. He, as in, played and coached for the man himself.
Less interesting.
He always struck me as an otter.
Yeah, he's an otter, man.
Oh, gracious.
Dabo's more of an otter kind of guy. You can see him just shimmying down the hill at Clemson, can't you? Like, you know, then give him a slip and slide.
I can see this sailing right over your head.
Yeah, no, I'm taking it in a completely different direction, ignoring that one. I didn't miss that on
just round. Like they do at Clemson.
Yeah. This all started, though, because you would figure, oh, well, we made kind of a weird hire. And the year prior must have been sheer hell. This must have been a regime that had to go and was underperforming. No. Alabama went 10-2 the year before. They went 10-2. So when I
well,
say
Well, what things, happened to the two?
Well, when I say things like, I have never told a joke about Alabama football, they'll fire 10-2, okay? They'll fire 10-2 easy. and I will give you the usual suspects in terms of ruining people's lives. One, Auburn University. Remember, the rule with Auburn is that Auburn ruins things. Auburn ruined Bill Curry's life at Alabama because you can win them all and beat everyone else and, in fact, go undefeated the entire year of 1989. And Bill Curry gets all the way to the Auburn game and loses 20-30. For the third time in a row, never beat Auburn in his tenure as Alabama head coach. They then go to play in the Sugar Bowl against Miami. Miami, a convenient villain that they are, hands them the 33-25 loss. Remember that one. It comes back around. So you think 10-2, I don't know, got some stuff to go. Maybe there's a problem here, but we can fix it because, you know, surely winning 10 games will save you because that's just outstanding performance at any university. Nope. They cheap out Bill Curry on some assistant pay. There's a couple of other disputes. And Bill Curry does the logical thing when life gives you lemons. You go to Kentucky and you take the lemons.
You go to Kentucky and you better take the lemons with you because they don't have citrus.
Yeah. And, you know, if you're going to make some bourbon beverages, it sort of helps cut that, right? Mm. Bill Curry goes to Kentucky, of all places, right?
To prevent scurvy.
To prevent scurvy.
Listen, Kentucky won't fire you if you're 10-2, will they?
No, one would have had to have gone 10-2.
They won't even fire you. As Bill Curry learned, they won't even fire you if you go 4-7 or 3-8.
We haven't talked a lot about the Alabama-Kentucky coaching pipeline.
He did the Bear Bryant in reverse. Bear Bryant went from Kentucky to Alabama. Bill Curry, he just flipped the script on everybody.
Like, I'm nothing like you, Dad.
Bye-bye. By the way, worst blowout I've ever seen in person, Tim Couch running the option at 95-degree heat at Florida.
And Tim Couch couldn't read. We know this now, right?
Listen, if he could read before that game, he could not read afterwards.
The final score of that game, 73-7, right?
Yes, that is correct. 73-7 because Bill Curry didn't hire Steve Spurrier when Georgia Tech was undergoing a regime change and Curry was taking over. And guess who happened to write that down in his little notebook of, motherfuckers, I got a paste. That's right, Steve Spurrier. So, 1990, going into this. This is Gene Stallings' first year. Expectations, one would assume that they're lowered. No. Alabama, everybody expects him to win every single game. This is Alabama's first game of the season versus the University of Southern Mississippi on September 8th. All right? It is also someone else's first game, though not his team's first game. It is Brett Lorenzo Farb's first game. All right?
Wait, is that for real his middle name?
Yeah.
God, I want to live in the world, the universe that's exactly like ours, except Brett Favre goes by his middle name.
Yeah, that is the man, Brett Lorenzo Favre, Gulfport, Mississippi zone, raised in the small town of Kiln. This is his senior year at the University of Southern Mississippi. He's got some pro notices, but, you know, still relatively below the radar, has a massive arm and has a unique situation coming in because he didn't play in the previous game, the week zero game for the University of Southern Mississippi, a lackluster 12-0 win over Delta State. 12-0 over Delta State, by the way, in 90-degree heat. Nobody needed to do that. Nobody. Just didn't need to happen. I'm going to go ahead, College Football Reference, strike that one from the books. Didn't happen. No one enjoyed it. Brett Favre didn't play in it. It's not important. So he didn't play in that game. And the reason he didn't play in that game goes back to earlier that summer. You might sort of remember this. Go, oh, man, but didn't, like, Brett Favre had some sort of, like, crazy car accident. Oh, yeah. Yeah, he had an extremely crazy car accident.
He was killed by Matthew Broderick.
Oh, God. Well, why did you have to remind us that Ferris Bueller killed someone with his car?
Well, that took a turn.
Multiple, like, you just have to throw out, like, the worst moment in people's lives. Just throwing it in there.
And then later he did a car commercial, so.
Yeah, I'm gonna get this back on the rails by talking about something.
Did that have to happen?
No, none of it had to.
Right. No.
Spencer said he's gonna steer this back on the road.
Yeah, which Brett Favre did not do, okay?
Interesting.
On July 14th, 1990, Brett Favre went fishing off Dauphin Island. A couple of buddies, they've been drinking all day. The sports editor of the Sun-Herald told Jeff Perlman this for his book on Brett Favre. So by the time that they started to go, you know, like the hour and a half back to home, they were, you know, at least coming down off of being pretty well lubricated. Brett Favre was allegedly above the BAC, according to the editor of the Sun Herald. And, you know, law enforcement helped keep that on the low. The wheels left the road at one point that night on the way back, and Favre's car flipped 3 times, all right? And he came to rest against a tree and upside down in the most Gulf Coast thing I have heard today. His older brother, Scott, rushed to the wreck and opened the door with a golf club.
That's a sturdy golf club.
The 7-iron of life.
I'm hoping he didn't pull it open. I hope he just had to tee off and whack it open.
It was, I believe it was a 3-iron, according to the Perlman book. All right, and he broke it. But, you know, don't call for the jaws of life. When someone from the Redneck Riviera has a car accident, the guy with the irons in his trunk has this, okay? So they pull Favre out before the car burst into flame. Favre hit the steering wheel so hard it bruised his liver, a contusion-grade bruise against his liver. He hit one entire side of his body is bruised. He has a bruised vertebrae. He has multiple cuts. He suffers a complication as a result of, and I guess this is
just to be clear, multiple cuts is the least important part of that you've said so far.
Yeah. No, you got to do it all. You got to know how banged up this dude is, because that contusion in the liver, your largest, you know, your largest non-skin
organ.
That's
not super uncommon in like head-on collisions.
No, it's not. What was the problem was the blood clot that formed afterwards and necessitated the removal of 30 inches of his intestine.
Hmm. All right. Is there a chance that he put his liver through so much that it was tough enough to survive this? Because this is a man whose liver got a workout in the early 90s.
Yeah, but I think that happened because he played for the Falcons.
Well, there's that, but I mean, he moved to Wisconsin after that, so yeah,
I'm just gonna go ahead and blame that on Atlanta and Wisconsin, not on one accident and drinking done during college. Although
No. I'm saying his liver was so tough that it was able to withstand this.
I think that's a valid point.
This was liver training.
But it had built up like a carapace around it of Bud Heavy.
And now my liver is a beautiful butterfly.
So Favre, not exactly in the best shape, misses the opener, and they play their first real game against Alabama. Okay. You go, oh, hey, you know, where was this? This was at Southern Miss. Okay. Which maybe
that's not right, is it? I thought this game was in Birmingham.
Birmingham. They played at Legion Field.
Which, again,
that's how you know things
suboptimal.
Maybe weren't right.
Legion Field, the Southern Miss of Birmingham.
You think your body's been through enough, Brett Favre? How about tetanus?
You've got it whether you want it or not.
It's airborne.
So on one side, we've got Gene Stallings coaching in his first game. Might I remind you, Bear Bryant lost his first game. All right. On the other side, we have Curly Hallman. Every LSU fan of a certain age just puked. I'm really sorry about that. We should have had a Curly Hallman trigger warning here.
We'll put it in the episode notes.
Yeah, he's 16-28 in 4 seasons at LSU and finishes just like dead. Like LSU is just dead in the water and later gives his job to Jerry DiNardo. Never coaches again. Like Curly Hallman can't get a high school job after that. That's how bad it is. Curly Hallman, by the way, he's a Bear guy as well. 8-4. In the year 1990 for Southern Miss. Southern Miss did, they played it close to the vest. They didn't win games by much. They didn't lose games by much. They end up, by the way, they didn't lose any of their 4 games by more than 4 points. And you're thinking, oh man, they got Brett Favre. They're really letting it loose. Brett Favre threw for 1,500 yards that season. 1,500. Option quarterbacks. There are option quarterbacks who had more yards than Brett Favre. He also just throws 7 touchdowns to 6 interceptions. You go, oh man, that kind of sucks. That doesn't seem like exceptional performance. Oh, it is compared to Alabama's quarterback that year. Gary Hollingsworth. You ever heard of Gary Hollingsworth?
No.
Oh, you're going to remember this because he throws 3 interceptions on multiple occasions this season. He threw 4 against Penn State the year prior, and they still won. All right? Gary Hollingsworth, God among men, all right? In this game, It is a weird game. Alabama is up at halftime, but man, Gary Hollingsworth, he's going to chip away at that lead. He throws a pick six. He throws two other interceptions. Brett Favre, you go, man, he must have had a heroic day. Yeah, he went out there. He played his first game of the season against Alabama in Birmingham, and he goes 9-for-17 with 125 yards. His biggest play is getting annihilated on a late hit on third and goal to draw a first and goal and extend a TD drive that they finish off with a rushing TD. And he does, with a key pass, get them in position for the long field goal that seals the win to beat the Crimson Tide 27-24. Gary Hollingsworth, meanwhile, three interceptions, baby. And then you know what he does versus Florida the next week? He throws three more all to the same guy.
Well, like yes. Brian said, now he knows how. I think that's called getting reps.
He threw them all to Will White, safety for Florida. All right, and Will
White, just being true to your brand.
Yeah, and Will White, when asked about it after the game, said, and I quote, "He really looks at his receivers."
Hey, who was that fine young quarterback's position coach at the time?
The offensive coordinator at the time was Mal Moore.
Interesting. Thank you. No further questions.
Yeah. Mal Moore later paid all this back by becoming the athletic director, helped hire Nick Saban. Like, I don't know. He got it back on the back end, y'all. Okay? He made up for not tutoring Gary Hollingsworth correctly. Hollingsworth, by the way, finishes with four TDs.
Sorry. Did you say four? Like a single digit four?
For the entire season of 1990.
Okay.
All right. He finishes with four touchdowns, 13 interceptions.
Jesus Christ.
And averaged a whopping 3.4 yards per attempt.
I think that's adjusted. That's not total yards per attempt, but it's still terrible.
It's adjusted.
Yeah.
But you know what? I don't care. You can
Well, like adjusted, that means like penalizing you yards for, say, interceptions.
And sure, right.
There was a lot of those.
No, yeah, you're right.
No, he threw them big. He didn't like. No, I think most of his pick sixes were like 70 yards the other way. He had that Jarrett Lee thing of where if I'm gonna throw it, I'm gonna throw it real big. So Gene Stallings becomes the first Bama coach since Bear Bryant to lose his opener. He takes number 13 Alabama instantly out of national title contention by losing to Southern Miss, and then ensures it by losing. I want you to just imagine this, okay? Imagine this. The guy who's the new coach at Alabama with a losing record coming in loses his next two to Florida and Georgia. And then loses 9-0 on the road and state.
But it doesn't matter. Why?
December 1st, 1990, they beat Auburn 16-7.
Woo!
Not what Bill Curry couldn't do. Yeah, he wins 10 games. He got numbers on the board. They go undefeated against everybody else.
Can't spell 10 games without a zero, Paul.
But when it comes time for Cowtown to feel some shame, guess who got that whooping stick? That's right, Gene Stallings.
They also beat a Tennessee that was number 3 at the time.
I already said that.
we're just reviewing Bama season.
Like that's a 9-6 game. Just nobody won that game.
I already said that.
If you go by just raw points, Bama's defense was 5th in the country. Bama's offense was out of only 107 1A teams, 69th, scoring only 21 points a game.
Yeah, because beaten up by that Bama defense in practice all week.
Yeah, man, yeah. And, you know, like, this was kind of Southern Miss's thing. They beat Florida State the year before to open the season, and then they went on to finish 8-4, and Curly Holman, bound for glory, takes the LSU job, and is after 4 years is never seen again. Just absolutely botches it. Meanwhile, Gene Stallings goes on to win a national title and beat who? They beat Miami. Beats Miami in the Sugar Bowl. So he ends up coming full circle, Gene Stallings. So where you start is not where you finish, all right? But where you start is sometimes hilariously bad.
Oh, that's way too on brand for the full cast.
So speaking of full circle, here's an example of the challenge of evaluating teams by transitive victory, which is a thing people like to do during the season when it works out better for their teams.
Why but we is my recognize team... in general that we just do that for fun, right?
Right, of
no,
course.
No, it Absolutely. Is the only way to measure.
Yeah, cool. I mean...
Never mind, carry on.
If you take transitive victory seriously, take a real honest shot at doing the entire top 25 based on nothing but that. You'll give up around like 16 and then you'll never bring it up again. But I do want to raise this.
Football is a food chain. That's how it works.
So BYU beat Miami 28-21. Miami beat Texas 46-3. Texas beat Texas A&M 28-27. Texas A&M beat BYU 65-14. You figure out that little loop right there, and you know.
All I'm hearing, Texas A&M national championship claim.
Giggle. The, let's see, 9-3-1. Perfect.